The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy.
Yeah. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today we're going to be touching on a topic related to virtual characters.
That's right. This was a topic that was suggested to us by our listener, Peter, who is quite involved in virtual reality these days. And he said, hey, you guys should do an episode on the Proteus effect.
Now, the Proteus effect is something that will deal with virtual characters. So we're going to be touching on video games and virtual environments and stuff like that. But even if you're somebody who has no personal interest in video games or anything like that, I hope you stick around because it's an interesting topic nonetheless. And I think it will ultimately have some relevance to yourself and the society you live in, even if you're not somebody who's ever played games or plans on playing games.
Yeah, because a lot of it does just hinge upon the idea of what happens when we put on this other face. And it could be – you can take it to the virtual reality extremes to where there is a body that I am occupying and I'm walking around in it within a virtual environment. Mm-hmm. There's the video game level of a character that I have picked out its face. I have picked out its clothing options, and now I am interacting with a digital world through it. But you can also take it down to the avatar level on various message boards or email threads, etc.
Yeah, totally. Now, if you're not familiar with how some of these video games work, where you create an avatar for yourself, this is a thing that happens in a lot of games. There's a character creation process. Not all games. Some games. Some games you don't actually even play as a character. You don't embody a person-shaped thing. They're like puzzle games and stuff. But in games where you play as a character of some type, some of them it's just a fictional pre-established character, but sometimes you get to create that character yourself, right? And there's usually at the beginning of the game some type of process you go through to do that. And you get to like pick what they look like and maybe pick what some of their personality attributes are or what some of their skills are. A lot of games have a thing like this. Robert, do you have a favorite character creation?
Yeah, well, I'd say the more recent games, I've really enjoyed the Skyrim and Fallout character creation suites. I feel like you have a lot of options there, and you can kind of create exactly the character you want. Thinking back to the older games, I was a big fan of Icewind Dale and Icewind Dale 2.
I have no idea what that is.
Well, these were turn-based Dungeons & Dragons role-playing games that you would play online, like top-down view. And they had
so it was virtual. It was not like a pen and paper.
No, not pen and paper. These were video games. It was the same engine as Baldur's Gate and Torment. Was another one, though Torment had pre-created characters, but was still a fabulous game. But the creation suite, especially on Icewind Dale 2, as I remember, they had some really cool character art you could select for the thumbnail. I believe through some minor tinkering, you could bring in outside art to serve as the thumbnail. Mm-hmm. And then you had these were not the most detailed of characters on the screen, but you had a fair amount of choice in how they were put together as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so one of the things we're going to be exploring today is what are the effects of coming to embody a character in a virtual environment? Mm-hmm. Does that change the player when you play as a character with certain physical or behavioral attributes? Now, Robert, the main character creation process in video games I remember from when I was younger is not as interesting as yours. It was the wrestler creation mode in the Nintendo 64 game WWF Warzone, which I played when I was in like 6th, 7th grade, I think.
This was an N64 game?
Yeah, and So it was this terrible blocky-looking wrestling game that had the WWF wrestlers in it, but you could create a custom wrestler. And so what my friends and I would always do is try to figure out how to create the most ridiculous looking wrestler you possibly could. Uh-huh. That had legs that were 5 times wider than his head and wearing some crazy Easter egg costume. And it was mainly for laughs, but we did put a lot of time and energy into it. It was like we had to achieve peak ridiculousness.
Huh. Well, the ultimate tragedy is that you were just a few years away from WWF WrestleMania 2000 and No Mercy, which were both N64 wrestling games built on the AKI Virtual Pro Wrestling engine from Japan.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, they were fabulous games. Just a fabulous engine for the game.
Okay.
But, you know, these wrestling games have come a long ways. I was never into creating myself in them because it just felt weird to me, but I knew people that would do it. And nowadays, you can like bring in scans of your own face or the scans of virtually any existing wrestler or celebrity and create an amazingly lifelike, just an immaculate representation of that individual in these updated wrestling games.
So you scan yourself in and you make a virtual copy of yourself, mm-hmm. and then watch it get beat down by Stone Cold or,
exactly.
or whoever.
Yeah, go through a table or bleed through its face. I mean, it's the technology is amazing. And yet at the same point, it's even stranger to me to try and imagine myself doing that, like creating a muscled avatar of myself that just goes in there and just gets beat to a bloody pulp.
Now, on one hand, you could look at that and say, okay, that's, it's just people horsing around, having fun, playing some games, which is generally true.
Yeah.
And if you take that attitude, you're probably not going to, think that there's anything super meaningful going on here. But on the other hand, it's really worth wondering how doing something like that could affect you and possibly change you. This is not a scenario that we are biologically adapted for in any way. Mm-hmm. I would say that there's no analogy in nature to creating a virtual environment in which you take on the characteristics of a created character and play within that virtual environment. I mean, I guess you could say that there are like rituals maybe where people sort of embody mythological characters that they play within the rituals, right?
Yeah.
But even then you're still bound to your body when you're doing that enactment.
Yeah. I mean, the only other example I can think of is just the mental time travel, chronesthesia, and imagining various scenarios occurring and extrapolating how you might react in those situations. But then you're still pretty much bound to yourself.
Yeah.
Unless there's a particular example from cultural history where someone is embodying, in this process, they are embodying the aspect of a god, but I am not aware of it if there is.
Well, yeah, I would say the imagination is pretty much the only equivalent space. Mm-hmm. But the imagination is not physically enacted. When you do virtual environments, you have to physically perform movements within those virtual environments. You have to, like, you know, you move a controller or something like that. It's a challenging process that you have to engage with and that is more continuous than imagination, which tends to kind of come in and out, right?
Yeah, the just merely imagining something or reading a book is probably not going to update your body schema or change the way that you're thinking about your own body.
Right. So you have to wonder, does the idea of playing as a character different than yourself change yourself? Does going into a virtual environment and embodying some other type of being make you a different kind of being in reality? And that's what we're going to be looking at today.
So let's take a moment to talk about just the name of the effect here, the Proteus effect.
Yeah. So who was Proteus?
Well, it would
seem... he was a character in The Matrix, right?
Was he? Was there a Proteus
no,
in The
I'm,
Matrix?
I'm just messing with
it's been
you.
A while since I've entered The Matrix. Well, you know, the funny thing is it would seem that fate would have us return once more to the world of undersea gods and humanoids. Because what we have here is Proteus from Greek mythology, the old man of the sea.
The old man of the sea.
Yeah, it's essentially a primordial sea god.
Okay.
As with all things mythological, Proteus's exact identity and his role shifts over time. But that's quite fitting for Proteus in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
In Giants, Monsters, and Dragons by Carol Rose, an encyclopedia of fantastic entities and creatures that I come back to again and again, she describes him as, quote, a primordial sea giant and, quote, a type of gigantic merman and guardian of the sea creatures.
Whoa.
And he served Poseidon, the sea god. He boasted the gift of prophecy as well. But you had to catch him to get him to share his prophecies.
Oh, wait, how do you catch him? Is that like rod and lure kind of catching? Or
essentially, it's like you got to chase him down and fight him, wrestle him, overcome him that way. But the problem is that Proteus can change his shape.
Oh.
He can change it into something more monstrous to escape you, swifter to escape you, etc. The secret, though, ends up being revealed by his daughter, Eldothea, who lets a few select mortals know that you have to catch him while he's sleeping on the island of Pharos.
Mm.
Now, various other accounts describe him as not only a shape changer, but a being that is just constantly changing shape, as being essentially formless, which is fitting because this is a god of the sea. This makes him like the sea itself. He is liquid. He is ever-changing, difficult to predict.
Kind of like those identity masks in A Scanner Darkly, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like never really taking a solid form, so you can't really identify somebody later.
Yeah, or and would make him difficult to catch as well. And this is where we get the word Protean, which means tending or able to change frequently or easily. Sometimes it's used just in the place of versatile. But I think that sort of usage is kind of an insult to the gods.
Yeah.
Because you might say that, say, Sammy Hagar is versatile in that he can front a band and run a tequila brand. But I think it's a bit much to say that Sammy Hagar is Protean.
Right.
Though that's impressive. I can do neither of those things.
No, I see what you're saying. Protean suggests more fundamental changes and commitments to different natures, right? Whereas versatile just says that you can multitask, you can do some different stuff.
Yeah, Protean almost has a sort of mad or holy vibe to it, right?
Yeah.
Like something that is Protean is difficult for us to master and grasp. And maybe the same is true of Sammy Hagar. I'm not sure. Certainly, it's hard to get him to commit to a speed limit. We know that much.
Robert, where'd all this Sammy Hagar come from?
I don't know.
You just listening to classic rock radio the other day? And
I was just trying to think of, well, who is an individual that's considered versatile in their interest? And
and Sammy Hagar?
Well, no, I initially thought of Maynard from Tool.
Okay.
But then I thought, well, I don't know. Maybe Maynard is Protean. I'm not sure. He's a mysterious dude. Let's
okay.
go with Sammy Hagar instead.
So I
more
see.
Clear cut.
You're saying Maynard from Tool, he does his alternative hard rock thing and he does his I've got a vineyard, I make wine mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah, and MMA.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He's into fighting?
Yeah. Yeah, he has multiple dimensions to his character.
I had no idea. It all comes back to wrestling in the end.
Yeah. Maybe not all that protean, but certainly versatile. But today we're not talking about Sammy Hagar. We're not talking about Maynard. We're not even really talking about Greek shapeshifters. We're talking about the internet, video games, virtual reality, and the idea that we get to pick and choose our form. And in doing so, maybe we get to choose our identity.
All right. Well, we will take a quick break. And when we come back, we will get into the original research on the Proteus effect.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right. Now, the short definition of the Proteus effect is that it is a name for the way that avatars, meaning virtual characters that we embody, it's a name for the way that avatars change our behavior in a virtual environment. So there was some original research on this subject between the years like 2007 and 2009 or so. That's when this first came out. And it was associated with the work of a researcher by the name of Nick Yi. And Nick Yi, he was the scientist behind the original Proteus effect. And he summarized his original research in an article I read from 2009, where he pointed out some of the main features that they had discovered in their first couple of studies on it. So Yi points out to start with, this was sort of like the starting basis of the idea, that putting on certain garments and clothing and uniforms has been shown to change people's behavior. For example, there are these experiments that show that when you dress subjects in black uniforms, they behave more aggressively than when you dress them in white uniforms. And experiments like these show that to some extent our behavior is influenced by visual self-perception. We act out the parts people would expect us to act out based on how we look. And I think this is probably the same kind of research that informs, or at least partially informs, the old business idea that you should dress for the job you want, not the job you have, right?
Yeah, dress for success.
Right. Now, I think that part of that advice is based on the reasoning that dressing that way will influence the people who have the power to hire or promote you, right? That you want to look the part, and so you're trying to influence others. But there's another side of that, that dressing for the job you want is also an influence on the self. It can also be a beneficial alteration of self-perception. If you dress like someone with a certain job, you'll probably find yourself behaving and performing more like someone who belongs in that job. You put the costume on, and the costume helps you get into character. But what this research shows with the way enclosed cognition changes us is that the costume tends to get you into character whether you mean to get into character or not.
Now, we've touched on enclosed cognition on the show in the past. Cognitive psychologist Hejo Adam and Adam Galinsky from Northwestern University coined the term. Mm-hmm. One of the most famous examples is the use of, say, a lab coat.
Right.
What happens when you wear a lab coat and maybe carry a clipboard around? They found that the effect would work. You would feel like smarter or more, in control of your doctor status here, but only if you wore the coat and were aware of the symbolic meaning. So you have to know what it's about, what it represents, and you actually have to essentially make it a part of your body by covering yourself in it.
Yeah, I would say that essentially the way this works is that you're performing according to stereotypes.
Yeah.
But you have to be aware of the stereotypes to perform according to them, right?
Right. And then according to Galinsky as well, we don't just think with our brains but with our bodies. And our thought processes are based on physical, quote, physical experiences that set off associated abstract concepts.
Yeah, I think – I mean, this might sound kind of silly, but I think about the way that wearing a suit jacket changes the way I behave. I think sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. And I very much associate it literally with the way my shoulders and my arms feel. Mm-hmm. When I put on a suit jacket, I feel the tension in the way the jacket constrains the movements of my shoulders, or not necessarily constrains them, but you can feel the jacket that's shaped like that, the suit jacket. And it actually does influence, I think, probably the way I talk. Probably to some extent the way I react to people, whether I'm more likely to shake somebody's hand. I mean, obviously there's no way to fully test this in a controlled way, but I strongly suspect that it changes my behavior, and it changes my behavior through a constant attenuated awareness of what my body feels like in that piece of clothing.
So you're not only dressing like Business Joe, you become Business Joe.
You know, Business Joe is different than a lot of other Business Joes because the suit jackets I wear are not like cool business jackets. They're more like old 70s jackets I got from my dad.
Okay.
Now, I think we do need to be careful with this kind of research because I think it's very easy to interpret it in an overly determinative way. For example, I was wondering, okay, are there studies that have found the opposite, that have found that this whole, you know, like wearing a black uniform doesn't actually change the way you behave compared to wearing some other colored uniform? And yeah, there are studies going the opposite way, not necessarily that undercut the original findings, but at least that showed that the effect is obviously not the same in all contexts. For example, the research has been applied to uniform colors in professional sports, and I found a 2010 study that found no correlation at all between uniform color and aggression in professional hockey.
This is the basic argument was that, like, if you wore red.
Right. If you wear, like, a red uniform or a black uniform or something, that you're going to be more aggressive than if you wear, like, a blue uniform or a green uniform. And this study found no correlation of that kind. It said it didn't matter what color uniforms the hockey players were wearing. But like I said, it doesn't mean the original research is wrong, just that it probably applies differently in different contexts and depends on a lot of different variables. So, but back to what was Yee's research to establish the idea of the Proteus effect? So in a series experiment starting with one published in 2007, Yee and colleagues tried to study whether the same perception embodiment, whether the same like embodiment of what others see you looking like that takes place with clothes and costumes also takes place with virtual costumes, meaning virtual characters. Does the virtual avatar that you choose to represent you in a video game or a virtual world change who you are and how you behave?
Now, this question instantly makes me think back to screens that I've seen of Second Life. I've never really used Second Life myself. But,
you say never really. Does that mean you have a little bit?
Well, what I did is that I attended a church service where the individual giving the sermon also did the sermon in Second Life.
Whoa.
And there were individuals gathered from across the country and I guess beyond in a virtual, if that's the right word for a Second Life environment, a virtual chapel to share in the sermon. And they were attending in various forms. So some people were women, some people were male, some people were like animals or animal-human hybrids.
Wow.
So I instantly thought to that and thought, well, you know, I wonder what was going on in each of their minds. Like, what did their chosen form say about their ideal identity, their experienced identity, et cetera?
I've never considered this question before. But what generally would the theologians of the various religions say about whether the rituals and sacraments of their religion are effective if performed virtually? So like if you, for example, receive Holy Communion in a mm-hmm. Christian church or do a ritual in any religion, but do it not physically with your body but virtually in a virtual environment, does the sacrament work? Does it confer the same benefit?
Huh. Well, that's a great question. I don't think this particular service involved communion, but maybe it did and I just forgot about it. I imagine that, though, of course, would hinge upon your faith's particular beliefs about communion. For instance, whether the bread actually becomes the body of Christ in your body, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, if you believe that, then why can't the digital communion wafer do the same thing somehow? I don't know.
Well, it takes me back to the techno-religion question we asked. I don't know if we ever got into this question in our techno-religion episodes, but we did talk about the idea of whether a virtual simulated prayer wheel is just as effective as a physical prayer wheel.
That's right. Because, of course, the traditional prayer wheels are essentially a machine that prays.
Yeah. Like in what tradition is it? Buddhist or
Buddhist, yes.
Yeah.
So it's a wheel that contains the prayer, usually like written down on a sheet of paper, and or not a sheet of paper, but a long string of paper coiled mm-hmm. up in there. And by turning it, you are turning the prayer. But how is that really that different from a digital machine doing the same thing?
Yeah.
It's an advancement in the technology, but it doesn't seem like it's an advancement in the basic idea.
Well, I find that a very interesting question, and maybe we can come back to it in the future, but we are getting off subject. Okay, so we're looking at the first study by Yee and colleagues, and this was in 2007 in Human Communication Research. And what the researchers did in this study is compare subjects with a virtual avatar designed to be either attractive or unattractive. So they had these virtual avatars that were rated as attractive avatars or not very attractive ones. And then they had the subjects who embodied those avatars, who were paired with them, interact with a virtual stranger controlled by a lab assistant. And subjects with attractive virtual representation, so if you got a very good-looking avatar, they behaved differently than those with unattractive ones. The virtually attractive players got closer to their conversation partners, and they shared more personal information with these virtual strangers than people who had been given unattractive avatars to perform with. So that's kind of interesting because the attractiveness of your avatar doesn't change anything about you, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't change whether you are naturally a confident or attractive person, does it?
Well, that's kind of the question here, right? Does taking on this virtual skin change your performance? Are you like fully sleeving yourself into this identity?
I mean, I guess it wouldn't change what you physically look like.
No,
it might over time, but it doesn't. It doesn't immediately change what you physically look like, but it might actually change the way your brain works. In another study, Yi found a similar thing. The researchers found that the height of a virtual character avatar influenced behavior in virtual bargaining tasks. So they had people go into a virtual world, you go into like this video game environment, and you have to bargain with somebody. And people with taller avatars relative to their virtual conversation partner negotiated more aggressively than people who were given shorter avatars.
Huh.
So it's not that you are a taller person in real life, but if you're just given a taller character to play as in the virtual world, you act with more like aggressive bargaining tactics and confidence.
Interesting. It becomes a situation where, again, humans have not evolved for this. We've evolved to deal with things in the real.
Yeah.
And then when we deal with things in the virtual world, we are still behaving as if we are beholding a physical presence.
Yeah. But maybe that's not so surprising, right? Because what this is that the avatar is changing our behavior within the virtual world itself. You're given a character to perform as inside a virtual world. It changes how you behave in the virtual world. The big question would be, does this change carry over into the rest of your life? Like once you leave the garment of a digital avatar behind, are there lingering effects?
So if you play a giant for an hour in a virtual environment, or certainly you embody a giant for that amount of time, do you then leave your virtual session behaving as a giant?
Yes. And in a 2009 study, Yi and colleagues investigated this. So they attempted to replicate the attractiveness study from the previous paper, right? So you'd get assigned an avatar that was either attractive or not attractive. And then they added a second stage to the experiment. They had an additional task outside the original virtual environment. So subjects were given an avatar, attractive or unattractive. Then they had to do the interaction task from the first study. Then after that, they left the virtual environment. And they were asked to participate in what they were told was a different study. It's like, do you want to do another study now? This one was about online dating. And the participants were asked to create a profile on a college dating site that had been set up. It was like a mock site, not a real one. And they were given photos of 9 people of the gender they were interested in dating, and then asked to pick 2 of the 9 that they would most like to get to know better and get in contact with. And the study found that people who had been given attractive avatars chose more attractive partners on the dating site, and people who had been given less attractive avatars chose less attractive partners to contact on the dating site. And this would all seem to indicate that the attractiveness of the virtual character, the avatar they'd been given, was still shaping self-perception and confidence and behavior even after the players logged out and moved on to other things.
Wow. So we are seeing the lingering effects then of the virtual body. This is the Proteus effect in action.
Well, I mean, it makes me wonder. So when I was in seventh grade or whatever, and I was creating ridiculous looking wrestlers with like huge legs and mm-hmm. stuff to get beat down by Stone Cold Steve Austin, and my friends and I laughed and thought it was funny. Did this follow me? How was I different after I stopped playing the game? Maybe it had no effect, but did this change who I was when I was a little middle schooler?
Huh. I don't know. I mean, I'm having to go back and think on my past video game experience as well. I mean, because one issue that comes up specifically deals with the use of sexy characters, especially the sort of sexy female characters that you often encounter in fantasy and sci-fi properties. You know, maybe it's they're scantily dressed, or mm-hmm. or we've all seen examples of this where the male figure has more traditional armor, and the female figure has armor that makes no sense within the confines of an actual combat scenario. It's just all about revealing the feminine form.
Yeah, totally. I remember before I was even aware, really, when I was much younger, when I was not really aware yet of feminist critiques of video games mm-hmm. or anything like that, I do remember seeing some of the character designs for female characters and thinking my younger self, like, that just doesn't make a lot of sense.
I don't think she would be very warm in that. Yeah.
But yeah, obviously this is a big question in video game design and stuff like that. The objectification, especially of female bodies in these games, is a big cultural point to talk about. But the idea of the Proteus effect takes it a little bit farther, right? So it's not just an idea of how women's bodies are represented in the games and to what extent the way they're represented is empowering or disempowering, but it also has to do with how it affects us to play as these types of characters.
Exactly. So I ran across a paper that deals with this, a 2012 paper titled The Embodiment of Sexualized Virtual Selves, The Proteus Effect and Experiences of Self-Objectification via Avatars. This is by Jesse Fox, Jeremy N. Balinson, and Liz Tracase. So in this study, they took the Proteus effect and they studied it in the light of two other key factors.
Okay.
First of all, objectification theory. Mm-hmm. So this is the idea that society treats women as depersonalized objects rather than individuals, mere sexual bodies, and that women come to internalize this and learn to see and value themselves based on their physical appearance. And this is known as self-objectification.
Okay.
And then the other is rape myth acceptance. So simply put, the acceptance of various myths concerning rape, most famously that dressing a certain way, going certain places, or behaving in certain ways means that the woman is, quote unquote, asking for it.
Right. It's like shifting the blame onto the victim of the rape.
Yeah, yeah. It's victim blaming, pure and simple. It's repellent. And it's also truly damaging because, as the authors point out, past studies have found that women who accept these myths don't take proper precautions against rape, and men who accept these myths are more likely to commit rape.
Okay.
So the researchers here, they went into their study with two predictions. First, they figured that the use of sexualized avatars would result in more body-related thoughts. And then second, participants who wear a sexualized avatar will express more rape myth acceptance, or RMA.
Okay, so the idea here is if you are given an avatar in a virtual environment that that has all these overtly sexualized features, that's designed in a sexually objectified way, it's going to increase your self-objectification, and it's going to increase the likelihood that you will accept these harmful myths about rape.
Right. It, basically, one way of looking at it is, okay, so you have an image of a scantily clad elven warrior, mm-hmm. okay? That depiction of even a non-human, technically female form, that is the at least partially the result of all of this these cultural energies, these cultural practices and beliefs that are taking place and sort of pressurizing this into form. And then if you embody that form, then you are subject to those pressures as well, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. A lot of the way the Proteus effect seems to work is by importing of stereotyped behaviors.
Yeah.
So there are stereotypes about how a person who looks like X is supposed to behave. When you're given a character that looks like that, looks like X to embody, you begin behaving with those stereotypes in mind.
Yeah, and even subconsciously. It's not necessarily an overt practice that's going on here. So this particular study involved 86 female participants from a West Coast university, ages 18 through 41. And it was a reasonably racially diverse group as well, 52% white, 24.4% Asian or Asian American, 7% black, 2.3% Latino, 2.3% multiracial, and 5.8% other. Mm-hmm. And they were placed in a fully immersive VR rig. Participants had their photographs taken with a digital camera for a presumably unrelated study so that these could be worn as faces essentially so they could give their virtual avatar their own face. And they also allowed for others to wear an appropriately aged female face that was not their own. So here's how the study went down. They were randomly assigned to one of four conditions, either a sexualized version of themselves, so it's their face but the sexualized avatar body, a sexualized other, where they're just in a sexualized body but it's just somebody else's face
just
on there.
Just a random character.
Mm-hmm. Non-sexualized self, so it's you and, you know, I guess, you know, you're just dressed in normal virtual clothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then non-sexualized other, where you're a non-sexualized person with a different face.
Okay.
And then they had them interact with a male – well, first of all, they had to look in a mirror to sort of behold themselves. And then they interacted with a male character.
Okay.
The researchers found that, indeed, participants in sexualized conditions reported significantly more body-related thoughts. So the face itself had no effect there. As for rape myth acceptance, judged by the use of Burt's RMA scale from 1980, which uses a series of questions, this is what they found out. Participants who wore the sexualized self expressed greater RMA than participants with a sexualized other. And there was no significant difference between the two non-sexualized VR bodies.
Well, that's a disturbing finding.
Yeah. Now, the authors in all this, they acknowledge that this was a small study, limited in scope. You know, it's just, you know, less than 100 women from a single college. But they concluded from this that women can be affected negatively by the avatars they wear, and it can alter their behavior both on and offline.
I think that would be an important thing to keep looking into and see if you can replicate because, I mean, there are tons of video games that, as we've said, have these overtly sexualized female bodies that characters or that players embody. And if it leads to something as truly harmful as acceptance of dangerous rape myths and victim blaming, this is something that could have a very strong effect on society and would be important to know.
Yeah, and likewise, I would love to see more on the potential effects on male players as well.
Yeah.
Because the argument here is not that females are wired in a weird way and therefore are susceptible to this influence, susceptible to like the sexual Proteus effect. Obviously, men would be susceptible to this too, even though the stereotypes that are involved in this particular study are very female-centric. But it comes back to the wrestling games, for instance. You know, like what happens if a male player is then putting their face on this body with this like ridiculous muscle man physique and then engaging in physical violence with another character? Like what kind of protean effect would that have on the individual?
Yeah, I think one thing that's not clear yet is how potentially strong this effect is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are obviously going to be variables, no matter what, even if we don't know what they are yet, they're going to be variables that make this effect stronger or less strong to the extent that it's true at all. But I wonder how potentially strong is it? You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
At its most strong, will it have a little bit of an effect that we walk away with when we're done playing the game? Or are there ways that you could tweak and fine-tune the gaming and avatar embodiment experience that could have radical or revolutionary self-editing types of effects, you know? Like, I'm almost wondering if there could be, like, avatar therapy. Like, you have a person who has harmful or self-destructive types of self-perception issues, and that with a finely tweaked virtual environment and finely tweaked type of avatar, you could actually treat that sort of condition.
Yeah, well, I mean, this wouldn't be the first time people have proposed treating or studied the treatment of various ailments through virtual reality. Mm-hmm. There have been studies into the use of virtual reality to treat nicotine addiction, for example, or post-traumatic stress disorders. So, I mean, that's one of the things about virtual reality is that there are a number of possibilities there beyond mere entertainment or distraction, and we should probably cover more of them on the show. I feel like we haven't really touched on VR in quite a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, one thing I've read along these lines is that I came across a study from 2014 applying the idea of the Proteus effect to the idea of exercise games.
Hmm.
So this was a study published by Benjamin Lee et al. In Games for Health, Research, Development, and Clinical Applications. So this was a study about exercise games and how they can be used to try to encourage fitness behaviors in children. And the study was called We, Myself, and Size, The Influence of Proteus Effect and Stereotype Threat on Overweight Children's Exercise Motivation and Behavior in Exer Games. So this is going to be one example of the kind of thing I was just talking about, right? Like taking advantage of the Proteus Effect to try to optimize people's performance and self-improvement behaviors. And the idea here is that if you can get children to exercise more based on exercise video games by using different types of avatars. So they tested 140 children between 9 and 12 years of age who were overweight. The dependent variables they tested were exercise attitudes of the children, exercise motivation that was platform specific, specifically like how motivated are you to exercise on this Wii game you've got. And then finally, their performance inside the exercise game. And what they ultimately claimed to find was that overweight children who were given avatars that looked overweight performed worse compared to children who were given avatars of a normal body size. So if you're given an avatar that looks fitter, that looks healthier, you do better in all four of the dependent variable categories. And they also tested stuff about stereotype threat, like whether giving these children negative stereotypes about exercise motivation in overweight children would hurt their performance. And that also did seem to matter. So it turns out that you don't want to give children negative stereotypes about how they might perform in these video games if you want them to do better, but also just changing what the avatar they use looks like can really matter in how they do with exercise motivation and exercise performance in the games.
Well, I've never played a fitness video game per se, but I can see where that would have an effect.
Yet again, I want to ask the question I asked a minute ago. I wonder, to whatever extent this effect is real, how strong could it possibly be?
Yeah.
Like, is the most you could hope for that you'll get a slight improvement with this kind of thing? Or could you tweak and keep testing these types of avatar changes until you find just the right formula to really make a huge difference in the way people's brains work in these tasks?
Yeah, indeed. Indeed.
Another interesting way that I found this being studied was the idea of performing stereotyped gendered behaviors in video games based on the gender of the avatar you've been given. So there are stereotypes about how certain genders should behave in video games. One would be that there's a stereotype that females would like in a battle game where you're like dealing damage to enemies and then performing healing spells or something like that, where you're healing yourself and healing others.
This would be a massive multiplayer online deal where you're playing with other human players in the virtual realm.
Yeah, so imagine a game like World of Warcraft or something. You can like hack at the monster, you can heal yourself. And the stereotype would say that, well, male players are going to hack more and heal less, and that female players are going to heal more and hack less. To whatever, that might not be true about real performance with gender identity at all, but that's like the stereotyped idea. And it turns out that players, that difference doesn't appear so much in the actual gender identities of players, but it does appear more so with the virtual identities of characters. So whether or not the player is actually identifies as male or female, the character that they're playing as in the game will conform to those stereotyped behaviors more. Like, people playing as virtual female characters heal more.
Interesting, huh? You know, I can't help but think again about Skyrim as an example, a possible example, or at least an area for study in all of this, where you have these various official expansions that came out that allowed your character to not only marry but to adopt children and essentially grow a family in this game that's mostly about killing monsters and exploring. to what extent does the Proteus effect rear its ugly head here as well? But indeed, could a game like Skyrim make you a better parent?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I come back to something that this is obviously not a very original idea. People have been asking this ever since the days of Doom and stuff in the 90s. But I wonder about the Proteus effect-like effects of first-person shooters. I admit I'm not a big fan of many first-person shooters. The few that I like are, you know, I like the BioShock games because they've got interesting environments and storylines and stuff. But generally, I don't really like games where you just become a gun mm-hmm. and you're just walking around and all you are is a gun poking into the world and then that gun shoots.
Well, there's something kind of holy and American about that, Joe. But
I can't think of many games like that that I find very enjoyable. I don't even bother with them generally now. But there's something about the embodiment as a gun that has kind of creepy Proteus effect implications.
Oh, well, I mean, we could go on an entire tangent there because on one hand, a gun is a tool that you hold in the real. And when you hold a gun or any tool in the real, your body schema adjusts to its presence. And that tool or weapon, that gun, that sword, it becomes an extension of your body.
Yeah, but in these games, it's all you see of your body. It's the only part of you there is.
We need to play some of the updated ones because like the latest Doom, your arms are in there because you're ripping open the heads of demons and stomping their faces and all sorts of gory effects.
Now, at the same time that I think all this is interesting to wonder about, I don't want to over-speculate or oversell confidence on video game panic because I haven't seen any convincing evidence that like playing a first-person shooter makes you a killer or anything like that. But it does make you think.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we have a few additional ideas I want to share and some closing thoughts.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
I'm Elliot Connie, and this is Family Therapy.
My best hopes, I guess, identify the life that I want and work towards it.
I never seen a man take care of my mother the way she needed to be taken care of.
I get the impression that you don't feel like you've done everything right as a father. Is that true?
That's true. And I'm not offended by that.
Thank you for going through those things and thank you for overcoming them.
Thank God for the limits.
Every time I have one of our sessions be positive. It just keeps me going.
I feel like my focus is redirected in a different aspect of my life now.
So, how'd we do today?
We did good.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy. Listen now on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So we were talking about violent video games and games where you become a gun or a murderous space marine or you know, any number of variations on this theme. And I actually ran across a piece in Ian Magazine, which we frequently cite. They have a wonderful storehouse of essays about a variety of topics.
Always thought-provoking.
Yeah. And this one by Angela Buckingham makes the case that murder should be illegal in virtual reality as well as, you know, our actual reality. And she uses the Proteus effect to make her case.
Huh.
Yeah. So I just wanted to read one quick quote from it. She says, "In an immersive virtual environment, what will it be like to kill? Surely a terrifying, electrifying, even thrilling experience. But by embodying killers, we risk making violence more tantalizing, training ourselves in cruelty and normalizing aggression. The possibility of building fantasy worlds excites me as a filmmaker, but as a human being, I think we must be wary."
No, I can hear all of the video game players out there in the audience saying like, "No, don't limit my freedom." You know, well, you'll say like, "Hold on, I've played lots of violent video games that are highly realistic and you do all kinds of fighting and destruction and killing, but I'm a perfectly peaceful person. I would never want to hurt anybody." You know, you want to use yourself as the anecdotal example against what she's arguing. But while I'm not saying I agree with her, I think we should take this idea seriously.
Yeah.
It's something to think about, that the idea that as games become more realistic, as the way we embody the characters we play in them becomes more immersive and more compelling, the Proteus effects that they produce could become stronger and stronger.
Yeah. In this essay, Buckingham references the work of German philosopher Thomas Metzinger. And I looked up an interview with him from 2016 in New Scientist. So I'm going to read this, but I want to drive home before I even read it that Metzinger is not a Luddite. He is not opposed to VR. He's expressed excitement for the possibilities of VR, but he is just saying let us be cautious. Let us study what is happening as we proceed.
Mm-hmm.
He says, quote, "There may be a risk of depersonalization, where after an extended immersion in a virtual environment, your physical body may seem unreal to you. Fully immersive experiences have a bigger and more lasting impact on people's behavior and psychology. We know from the rubber hand illusion that our brains can be fooled into thinking that an inanimate rubber hand is our own. In VR environments, we can be fooled into thinking that we are our avatars. Consumers must understand that not all of the risks are known in advance. There may be a tiny percentage of the population that has a certain psychiatric vulnerability, such that binging on VR may result in a prolonged psychotic episode. One can only speculate."
Yet again, I think that is an idea worth taking very seriously. Now, you can cite the examples, the anecdotes of, you know, I and my friends, we play these video games, we play violent games, and we would never hurt a fly. We're, you know, we're very nice people. But you are there taking a small sample. When you apply these stimuli to vast populations, it's possible that some subset of the population could have very strong responses to them.
I mean, certainly we see this with responses to other forms of media.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that some people are more vulnerable to cueing than others and are more susceptible to influences from fiction, from movies, from music, et cetera. So
I think it's interesting that he invokes the idea of the rubber hand illusion.
Mm-hmm.
If you've never seen this research, you should look up some of these videos on YouTube or even try it yourself, where you can put two hands on a table and one of them is your real hand and the other hand is a fake hand that's not actually yours. And somebody like maybe like strokes both hands or something long enough to give you – to get you to start imagining that the fake hand is also your real hand.
Yeah.
Then if you hit that fake hand with a hammer, people will freak out. They for a second, they think it's their actual hand.
Yeah. And this is another case where I'd love to hear from listeners who have more experience with VR video games, for instance, than we do. For instance, I know we're both fans of the Alien Isolation game that came out a few years back.
Oh, yeah.
And it's my understanding that one can play that in a virtual environment, which sounds absolutely terrifying because when I played that game, I felt like I was actually hiding in a locker waiting for the xenomorph to pass. I can't imagine playing it in a more personal virtual environment.
That's an interesting game because as we talk about Proteus effects and the way they change our brains, lots of first-person games, as we were talking about earlier, are very – the character has a lot of agency and commits a lot of violence maybe and is very powerful and dominant when you're in Doom or something and you become a gun and you're just killing all these monsters. In this Alien game and some other recent generation of horror games, you're very powerless. You have nothing you can really do to beat the monster. It's about hiding and it's about cleverness and powerlessness and how to sneak away and survive. And it's a very different type of experience than a lot of other games of this generation.
Yeah, and it really more fitting with the human condition.
Right.
We don't succeed in life by being just unstoppable killing machines. We do it by hiding in lockers and under tables and waiting till the danger passes.
And holding your breath.
That's right. You got to hold your breath. It's always important.
Now, I guess one thing we could say here is that we've sort of strayed a little bit from the core of the Proteus effect because we've gone on to just talk about how whole game mechanics, you know, everything about a video game can change the way we think, the things you have to do in it, the type of visual experience it is. But to bring it back to the idea of the avatar itself, not what the game is, but the appearance and the attributes of the character you play as and how that can shape your mind, I am brought to a question that goes outside of virtual environments or maybe goes actually to get back to the very place we started, the analogy between virtual environments and the only thing like them in prehistory being the imagination. Robert, I'm curious if in your Dungeons and Dragons experiences you've ever seen anything like the Proteus effect. Like, do the characters people create for a D&D session change the way the players themselves behave even once they leave the game, even when not explicitly role-playing? Like, does a person playing a lawful good paladin take a break to order pizza differently from that same player if they're currently running some chaotic evil beast that eats people?
Oh, that's a great question. I have to say, first of all, there are different types of players, and some get into the role-playing aspect of it more than others. The people I play with, none of them are using a chaotic evil character. Everybody's character seems to be a partial extension of their own personality, but maybe they're leaning into certain things more than others. Like one player was very argumentative as his character, but he's also a little bit argumentative in life.
Right.
But maybe he was a little more argumentative when he was playing this character. Another plays a character that is kind of gregarious, and sometimes I see him behaving in a gregarious way that seems like an extension of his character. But it's kind of a chicken and egg scenario there, right?
You know, right.
They're not necessarily acting out in a way that is different from themselves. They're just sort of leaning into this version of who they already are.
Well, another way to think about that is that they could actually be using some version of the Proteus effect, a little bit different because it's not in virtual environments. But let's go back to a virtual environment.
Okay.
I think people could use some version of the Proteus effect to essentially intentionally edit their own personality. You know, it's kind of hard to change who you are, but I would say that the most surefire way to make changes to yourself is not through thinking about them, but through doing things, right? If you want to change who you are, change your behavior first and your nature will follow.
And to that point, I have to say that the people that I've played with, they tend to want to be noble. They want to be the heroes of the story.
Yeah.
And save the day, which is great because that's the kind of game I want to play. And DM, I don't really want to DM a game where everyone is a marauding jerkwad, you
right.
know, and they're just tearing apart towns, because then that does begin to feel a little icky, I would think. But then again, I would love to hear from anyone out there who's been in a game like that. Have you been in a chaotic evil, essentially, like maybe there's a Blood Meridian role-playing module out there that people are really crazy about, and you can tell me about it. But I, for one, would not want to run or participate in the Cormac McCarthy Blood Meridian Dungeons & Dragons kind of campaign.
But then everybody just fights over whether they get to be Judge Holden.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would hope Judge Holden is an NPC. But yeah, well, but that's an idea. Like, you just have a party of Judge Holdens rolling around being
awful.
That
sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Why would that be even fun?
I don't know.
But, okay, so I was talking about the idea of editing the self. Now, you can imagine, to whatever extent the Proteus effect is real, that you could exploit it to intentionally edit your own personality in a direction of your choosing, right?
Ah.
So you could say, like, what if I want to be a character more like X? You could intentionally seek out virtual environments where you have to play as a character who has those attributes you're seeking. Essentially, you'd be virtually faking it till you make it. You'd be enacting the behavior to shape yourself in the real world as a byproduct.
Interesting. Yeah. Again, we get back to the idea of VR therapy. But, you know, to allude to another episode we've done before, do you think there might be a Proteus effect in place with the game of Werewolf or Mafia?
Oh, I wonder. Does playing that game again, we're getting a little bit off of the core of the Proteus effect having to do with avatars and getting more into like game mechanics and behavior. But yeah, does it train you to be a liar? Like if you play Werewolf a lot, does it make you a less honest person?
Yeah, or just a paranoid and judgmental person.
Oh, yeah. I want to offer one more weird take. See what you think about this. Maybe this is a terrible take.
All right.
Though I also think I can't be the first person to suggest this, so I'm sure other people have written about this. Social media, we've been talking about MMORPGs, massive multiplayer online RPGs. I would say social media today is an MMORPG.
Yeah.
It's not just like one. It literally is one. It is a massive multiplayer online role-playing game. If you just take Twitter, for example, it's a massive online environment in which you create a character, and that character is based on you but isn't actually you. It is a representation of you composed of little segments of information and behavior that you choose to add to that profile of that version of you. It's a character you create interacting with millions more who are doing the same thing, playing roles of a character they've created. And some players are casual and they don't play very much and they don't play their role very consistently. They just pop in and out. Others are power players and kind of addicts of the game. They play it all the time. Sometimes these players form loose teams and go out and fight oppositely aligned enemy players in the virtual space. I think Twitter really does work in a lot of ways kind of like one of these games, like World of Warcraft or something, except the character creation is just less constrained by the fantasy environment of the game.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I feel like we could go wild with that concept, discussing how social media changes who we are.
Yeah, but I mean, I think on this model, you have to wonder about the feedback loop of how the character you create on social media feeds back into who you actually are and how that changes the way you play your character online. It creates some kind of self-sustaining feedback loop, but in what drives that loop and in what direction does it go?
Here's one more scary thought. So in all of this, we invoke the mythic Proteus, and seemingly, you know, it's just meant to refer to the idea of changing forms.
Right.
And I don't think there's actually more to it than that. But if we're to have fun with the concept, let's not forget that Proteus also had that gift of unerring prophecy.
That's oh, no.
So not only would he prophesize the future, but his visions were absolute. They were unquestionable. So if forced to, he can tell you who you are, who you will be, what you will do. And I wonder if the danger, or perhaps the promise in some cases here, of the Proteus effect isn't that it will make you someone that you are not, but that it will let you become who you really are.
Hmm. Well, it makes me ask the question, who are we but what we are?
What more could we do being what we are?
You are what you do, even if it's online.
Just do it. All right. On that note, we want to remind you, check out StuffToBlowYourMind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the podcast. You'll also find links out to our various social media accounts, such as Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
And big thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us, the hosts of this show, to let us know a topic you'd like us to cover in the future, or to give us feedback on this episode or any other, or just to share some thoughts with us or say hi, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.